against Horvitz.
Good morning. My name is Gareth Morris.
Mr. Morris, wait. I will call you when we're ready.
Forgive me, Your Honor.
Mr. Morris.
Good morning again, and forgive me for my over-eagerness.
Always wait to allow the other side to find a seat.
May it please the Court and the opposing counsel. This case involves the question of whether the Court erroneously admitted uncharged acts of child molestation to be heard by the jury, and particularly the fact that they were heard prior to the evidence of the charged offenses. The government, in its motion in limine, proposed to the Court that it consider the balancing test under Rule 403 and cited to the case of LeMay, a Tenth Circuit opinion. And the critical factor in that, and the disputed one, is whether the Court considered the necessity for this evidence. The fifth factor, quoted in the government's motion limine, is the necessity of the evidence beyond the testimony already offered at trial. There's no way to compare the need for this evidence until you know what the testimony is that's offered at trial. The Court couldn't possibly do that and make a final decision about the admissibility of the prior offenses, which were long since barred by the statute of limitations.
How old is Mr. Horvitz?
Forgive me, there's an error in the brief. I said he was born in 1990.
I know he wasn't born then.
He was in his 60s. I don't know his exact age, but he was...
That was probably supposed to be 1940, probably. So he'd be about 66.
Yes.
And since 1973... he's been engaged in this, maybe before, since he was in his 30s, or maybe earlier.
That is the evidence, and it is the prejudicial. All evidence of child molestation is prejudicial.
Yeah.
When I first was appointed to handle this case, I couldn't quite sort of do it. I sort of kept pushing it away, and then I realized that visceral reaction to the evidence in this case is what the error was in this case, which is that the jury heard testimony from SC and MW about all these awful things that he did to them in the 70s before they ever heard what he was charged with. And it's the contention in my, which I think I've said as well as I can in the brief, that was the end of it. That now they know he's a child molester. In contrast to 404B, which in, say, a simple drug dealer case, if you mention in the opening statement, if the government says, by the way, you know, Mr. X was in prison, it's a motion for mistrial. This case came up here very recently. You start all over again. Just the mention of a prior act or prior offense is the end of the trial.
Well, would you prefer to be at the end of the trial then, where they bring this up after the little ones are already... you know, whatever, prove whatever he did to them in the last 5 years?
Yes, I think it, for two reasons, the risk of error goes way down. First of all, the jury doesn't form its opinion, which it does, I think, early on in cases, and I think there's some evidence that that's how they work. They form their opinion about him based on not on his propensities, not based on long-barred conduct that's alleged, but based on the charged offenses. The judge then has to do this balancing test between the necessity for the evidence and its prejudicial effect. In this case, there were three separate witnesses. The youngest was 14. The others were in their 30s. There was a therapist report that described how two of them in their teens came and talked to her about this. There wasn't a lot of doubt about the offense, but the jury didn't hear any of that, nor did the judge hear it or hear the cross-examination before it was decided to let in this highly prejudicial evidence. The purposes of 414, some of them were articulated to be that children make bad witnesses and can be bullied on cross-examination, and there's the need for corroboration, so you have to go back and get this other evidence. But that wasn't the case here. And if the court had waited, they would have seen that there was very limited cross-examination, no real challenge to the testimony.
Is the 14-year-old the one that said that he did this to her two or three times a week?
No, the first one was count one is the 14-year-old. She's the one with this bizarre incident on the logging road, and
the one that he didn't. It was just
there
an
was
attempt.
An attempt.
Okay, what was the one I'm thinking of? The one that testified to from the time pretty young to the, 9 or 10 or something.
I've sort of got stuck on the initials, but it was FB was a stepdaughter and DAS was a stepson, and those were the two that were involved in counts 2 through 8. Mm. Where there was long-term, ongoing abuse. So my concern here, and thank you for not yet asking me why this isn't harmless error, because I think that's the really difficult question here, is that 414 is such a dangerous abrogation of basic principles of justice. Here you have a person being, we say he's a child molester, but these are things he did long, long ago. How can he defend himself against those? Where's the presumption of innocence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt? It all doesn't matter. He's established as a child molester before the trial really starts. And I think that is a procedurally disturbing step for the court to be making that decision before it has to. And so I think that 414 ought to read, after you've heard everything that the government wants to put on, now decide, trial judge, whether this is so prejudicial compared to its probative value, or vice versa. That's where the decision should have been made. This court in Julian did this very same thing. It said, in light of the defense that was put on, I think it was the defense, but at least the government's case, it was appropriate to allow the conviction in. And most of the cases follow the same language. And in fact, that's what the government asked for at the beginning of our case. Beyond the testimonies already offered at trial, what's the need for this beyond the testimonies already offered at trial? If you don't have any further questions, that's the nub of my argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Ms. Kraft.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Carol Kraft. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I assisted at the trial of this case. The lead counsel was Penelope Fleming, now Penelope Koblenz. It's our position that there was absolutely no abuse of discretion on the part of Judge Griesbach when he admitted the 414 evidence involving the prior sexual molestation of the witness who was identified as MW and the witness who was identified as SC. Judge Griesbach made a thorough, complete, and very rational record of why it was that he was permitting this evidence. First, he very carefully considered its relevance in the order that he issued prior to trial. And I think that his discussion of relevance goes directly to the issue of necessity that counsel has raised in his challenge to this evidence. Judge Griesbach talked about how child witnesses are not believed because of their young age, and how in this particular case he was aware, based on the government's proffer, that there was no physical evidence, there was no DNA evidence, there were no fingerprints, there was no evidence of trauma, which is precisely the type of corroboration that one might expect a juror to want to see when they're evaluating the credibility of a child witness. The court will recall that during the testimony of several of these witnesses, DAS and FB, who were the stepchildren of the defendant, that they had a very difficult time recalling some of the specifics of what had happened to them, partly because of their age and partly because of the long duration of the conduct that the defendant engaged with them. That type of testimony, therefore, is necessary to have other things that will help to assist and corroborate. And Judge Griesbach very properly found that just by denying, just by pleading guilty, not guilty to these charges, Mr. Hopatas had raised the specter that he was challenging the credibility of these witnesses. And in his opening statement, the defendant, by his attorney, said that thing. He said he can only deny this and he can only challenge the witnesses and throw into doubt what it is that they are telling you. And so in his relevance discussion during the in the course of issuing the initial order, Judge Griesbach addressed the very necessity that counsel, I think, is looking for in his assertions here today. In addition, the judge, prior to trial, in that order, did do a balancing test, did weigh whether or not the 414 evidence was more prejudicial than probative, and found that it was not. He considered whether how similar it was to the offenses that were charged in this particular complaint, a particular indictment, and in fact, it was very similar. Now, it's also important to remember that these acts that these two men testified about, it's not like it was a long, horrendous description of many, many things that had happened over years. There were two incidents involving SC and two, and perhaps an attempt involving MW, but they were identical to the kind of conduct that DAS and FB described during their testimony. It was the defendant waking up in the middle of the night and the defendant having his erect penis in their buttocks trying to ejaculate. It was asking the juvenile witnesses to touch the defendant's penis in improper ways. It was exactly the same kind of conduct that was at issue in counts, I believe, 2 through 7 in this indictment. The judge also considered the proximity in time, the frequency of the other acts, the existence of intervening events, and the need for the testimony. And I would submit to the court that in its order, Judge Griesbach made a very reasoned finding as to why this evidence should be admitted. But he didn't automatically allow it to go in at that point in time. He did not allow the prosecution to address it in its opening statement, and he asked for more. He asked for some type of offer of proof so that he could be satisfied that the testimony itself would have reliability. He wanted to know where it came from, how the government came to have this testimony in the first place, so as to satisfy himself that there wasn't improper collusion or some improper reason for bringing this into the record. And so he asked for those offers of proof, and he was satisfied. And after he made another reasoned analysis on the record as to why he was satisfied, he permitted the evidence to come in. Now, counsel seems to think if he had waited until the end of the case, he would have concluded that the evidence wasn't necessary. But that's just not true at all. Presentation of the evidence at the point that it was a logical progression in how the testimony was presented at trial. If the court recalls, the SC, the young man, or the now 39-year-old man who testified that he had been assaulted by the defendant, sexually assaulted when he was 11 or 12, was responsible for his arrest after there was a long-standing warrant following the attempted assault of M.O. He had gone to his mother's home to return some kind of a cooker. His mother, who was married to the defendant's brother, said, "You're not going to want to go in there because Robert Hopatas is in there." SC was so angry, even after all of these years, about what he had done to him and something that he had at some point confided to his mother, that he went to the authorities and he said, "Your federal fugitive, the man that you're looking for, is at my mother's house right now." And so it was a logical point in the presentation of the case for the government to present his testimony then, and of course, certainly the rest of what had happened to him. And at that point, it was also logical to introduce the testimony of the second individual, M.W., who, like S.C. and like the named victims in the complaint, had a type of familial relationship with the defendant. His mother had been involved with the defendant at the time that the sexual assaults against him took place. His mother, in fact, had several children who were fathered by the defendant during that period of time. And so not only was it proper for Judge Griesbach to allow the testimony at the time that it was presented, but it was certainly proper testimony in light of the offenses that were charged. Congress had a good reason for making exceptions to this type of testimony and treating it differently than we treat 404B evidence, and Judge Griesbach did not abuse his discretion when he permitted it to be presented in this case. Does the court have any questions for me? If not, then that pretty much completes my argument.
Anything further, Mr. Morris?
think, with great respect for my opponent, that the government just did exactly what it did at the trial. It paraded the evidence that existed in 1973 and 75 that was not charged in the offense and said, look at the shocking conduct. Look at the kind of man that we're dealing with. And that's the whole problem, I think, with this propensity evidence. And the instruction, of course, that the judge gives, saying, well, only consider it for if it's relevant, but not with respect to whether or not the defendant committed these offenses, that instruction has no meaning in contrast to the impact of hearing what you just heard a brief summary of. And there just simply was no necessity. The judge, in addressing necessity, at page 10 of his order, said, as far as the need for testimony beyond what would already be required for trial without such evidence, the government notes that DAS and FB will be testifying in any event. Permitting them to recount the history of abuse outlined in the government's motion will not significantly increase the length of the trial. Now, we've never said that the DAS and FB shouldn't be allowed to go back behind the statute of limitations and tell the full story. And so the judge goes on. The only additional witness who would be called are SC and MW, whose testimony is unlikely to be lengthy. Whether it's lengthy or not is not the issue. The issue is whether it's prejudicial. We believe it was highly prejudicial. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Morris, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.